One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
So, two questions today, both on China. One, what about China's debt? Steve had previously said it was something we should be worried about, but has he changed his mind on that? And secondly, China is becoming a lot more authoritarian, even more so than before, and focusing more on its domestic economy as well. What would the world be like if we traded less with China? That's today on the Debunking Economics podcast with Professor Steve Keen. I'm Phil Dobby. Welcome along. Now, a fine example of China doing what we in the West would never do is the requirement that for all computer games players, they have to register if they're under 18 years old and be monitored to ensure they only play 3 hours of computer games a week, 1 hour on a Friday night, 1 hour on Saturday, 1 hour on Sunday, nothing at all on school nights. Social control, you might think. I know a lot of parents secretly think, well, that's not a bad idea. I wish we could get our kids down to just 3 hours of computer games a week. But we can add it, of course, to the list of the ways that Chinese authorities monitor and control their population. So we'll look at how we continue to trade with a country like that and whether we'll reach a breaking point where we say enough is enough. We've got to look at human rights and all that stuff. And that's going to have an impact on who we trade with. But before that, Hillian Macbeth, one of our listeners, Steve, says, I know you identified China as one of the countries likely to experience a crisis, along with Canada, Australia, Hong Kong, and so forth. Do you have an update on the private sector debt in China? And then on top of that, I'd like to add, you know, whether a more authoritarian China will see less trade with the West and how that's going to change the global community. So how is China changing, in other words? That's basically what we're going to look at. How is our relationship and how is the country changing? But let's start with debt, because they've got it all, haven't they? They've got government debt, they've got local authority debt, they've got private debt, and yet still, despite all this debt, their economy just seems to keep growing.
Yeah, I mean, just to give the absolute statistics on it, the level of government debt in China, and of course, if anywhere is able to successfully carry out the basic ideas of MMT, it's China, you know, in the sense that they're not worried about, they don't have any stupid politicians complaining about budget budget deficits in hindering future generations in China. That's 67% of GDP, and that's risen from back when the data began, which is 1996, from 22% of GDP. So it's basically tripled over the last, over the industrialization period of China, but it's still, on a global sense, quite relatively low. Private debt, and funnily enough, there's data on private debt going right back to 1986, which I find a bit remarkable because I think that's still during the days of the Gang of Four. But that was 64% of GDP. It's now 220%. Wow. So that puts China's private debt level at the level of countries like France, Australia, et cetera, et cetera. The interesting thing is when you break the debt down, you might think, given all the stuff about housing bubbles in China, we know that house prices have been rising ridiculously over there. It's actually predominantly corporate debt. So again, the series that the Bank of International Settlements provides starts in 2006 for China in terms of breaking down private debt into household and corporate. So there's a collected series going back to 1985, and there's a separated series from 2006. And household debt was 10% of GDP back in 2006. It's now 60%. So that's quite a six-fold increase. Mm. But that puts the level of household debt in China at about half the level of household debt in Australia, for example, which is, I think, a legitimate world record holder. I think the Swiss are taking steroids, possibly. The Swiss, the only country to beat Australia in a household debt to GDP ratio is Switzerland. And from what I've heard from friends of mine in Switzerland and people working in the banking sector there, a lot of it's the old Swiss gnomes hiding the wealth and hiding the debt of the rich in Switzerland. So I don't take the Swiss numbers seriously, but the Australian ones, of course, different story. But the corporate debt is the interesting one. And corporate debt, even right back in 2006, was 100% of GDP. Mm. Now, that exceeds America's level. It's currently 160%. And Interestingly enough, and this is one reason I take the data. I mean, you've got to be, you know, question data coming out of China. A lot of people that I know who specialize in China use data on, for example, energy consumption rather than GDP to work out what the GDP actually is rather than what the Chinese claim it is.
Interesting.
But, yeah. But the data shows a very similar phenomenon in China to what you find in the West as well. And that's a dramatic increase in corporate debt when COVID hit. So the level of corporate debt was peaked at 162% of, I think, 162% of GDP back in 2016. It was trending down, and you get to 2020, which of course is the beginning of COVID. It's down to 150% of GDP. And to put that in context, that's corporate debt at the same level as private debt in the USA. So a higher level of debt buyers. But then it rose rapidly. And in the, if you go from 150% in at the end of 2019, then it's one quarter later, 153, 156, 150, 160, 162. But then it tops that at 163%. Now it's heading down again. Now, of course, we know that China is one of the few countries, even again, you know, being skeptical about the statistics, China's lockdown worked to keep COVID under control. I think what China's total number of cases is, has it cracked 100,000? It's
ludicrously low. I don't know, but I mean, new cases, as they say, is down to zero, don't they? They're back to zero COVID. Whether they can maintain that or not, I don't know. But the but the reason why they're getting this big increase in corporate debt, obviously, is because they are making it easy for people. So whenever there's concerns about liquidity, for example, the People's Bank of China steps in with their, you know, what they call their medium term lending facility, which is basically a one year loan to the commercial banks. They just, you know, they've kept that low. It's at 2.95%. Obviously, it's not as low as it is elsewhere, but they, but they've also sort of said to commercial banks, you know, lower your reserve requirements. We're not too fussed about that.
That's a bit of a waste of time, but no, but yeah.
So lend out more money, and if lending out more money means you've got, you know, cash problems, don't worry, borrow it from us for a year and at a low interest rate. So it doesn't sound enormously sustainable, but I mean that's the way they're managing to put out these money to companies so that they can increase their debt. But there's a danger in that, isn't there? Because aren't they going to hit a point at which this debt could all come crumbling down? So there's a company, Evergrande, for example. It's one of the biggest companies in the world. It's got 1.95 trillion yuan debt, which is over $300 billion, more than the GDP of Finland. If a company like that fails, and it could, that's going to have a flow-on effect, isn't it, through a country like China? But I guess the assumption is that the Reserve Bank will do whatever it can to stop that happening. Too big to fail.
Oh, and all what you get is then the organization gets taken over by the government,
yeah,
and then reorganized and sold back into the private sector at a later date, which is the sort of thing which should happen in any functional capitalist economy. You go into receivership and try to, in the process of receivership, revive it such that it can be restarted afterwards, after the necessary debt write-off has occurred. And China's more likely to do that effectively than most Western countries.
But that's not good for risk management, is it? I mean, if you're running a company and you're told you can get as big as you want, get a cheap loan, look, if it all comes crashing down, don't worry, the government will buy you and sell you off again.
It depends on whether you get kicked out of the company and lose your shares and your shares go to zero and your bondholders lose their money. And I don't know the extent to which that happens in China, but that's what you'd want to have happen. The company continues as potentially going concern. The existing shareholders and bondholders lose their shirts. That's the correct way to go about it. And I don't know the extent to which that actually happens in China. There's bound to be an enormous amount of, if you're, you know, a favoured member of the party, then you're not going to lose your shirt. But if you're not a favoured member, you can end up in jail. And they've seen a fair bit of that happening as well recently.
So, okay, so that's corporate debt, which is growing and is perhaps not, I mean, you'd be thinking corporate debt growing is a good thing if you've got a growing economy, because it's there helping sustain growth. I mean, normally that would be taken as a good sign.
Well, corporations, you know, at least when corporations borrow, they're doing it to produce something they can actually sell.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of this is going to be housing speculation stuff as well. We've stopped talking about the abandoned skyscraper residences in China, but they're still there. And a lot of this, there's a way in which China's let itself get infected by the same disease the West has, which is people think that their savings are tied up in the value of real estate, and therefore the government's now feeling a bit of pressure to make sure real estate prices keep on rising. So that is partially where a bit of madness is coming from.
Even though there's not much of a market for it, because a lot of people do own their home, and a lot of them own it outright, because in the it was the 80s or the 90s, I think. People were, back then, a lot of properties were government owned, and then they sold them off to people at very low rates, so they could afford to buy them, and so that skewed the housing market somewhat, and so there might be a big increase in house prices, but it's people selling houses at a great value because they're asset rich, because they've basically been sitting on a property that they bought for a song.
Still friends, ex-girlfriend, was one of the people who bought one of those apartment in a set of high rises in a third tier city, high population less than 5 million people, I think. And, the thing was never going to be finished, and then on to the next property development. So there is a property bubble in China, and there are companies which did make a large amount of money out of it, and they could rely upon the house prices continuing to rise there. So that's the suspect side of both household debt and corporate debt.
But that's bad. Bad regulation, isn't it? That's making that happen.
Can you point to good regulation on house prices?
No, nowhere in the world. Yeah. Good point.
But a lot of the corporate debt is for financing investment. And I mean, the people often ask, why did Japan fall over after 1990? And of course, there was their private debt bubble. They actually reached a peak of 225% of GDP, which is higher. Let's see, did China beat them? Let's see. The Chinese topped that at 224% of GDP. That was in the middle of last year, and it's now trending down. The Japanese hit 225% of GDP in the aftermath of the collapse in 1990. There was still a bit of upwards momentum in debt levels. But the same sort of pattern applied, mainly corporate debt, not a large amount of household debt, despite the fact that there was a housing bubble. But the corporate debt, a large part of it was because Japanese corporations were debt financed predominantly. You had these units called keiretsus, industrial units like Mitsubishi and so on, where there'd be Mitsubishi Bank, which would provide working capital to Mitsubishi corporations. And therefore, rather than having a large equity base, they had a large private debt base. I don't know China as well as I know the Japanese story, but you can get real inside information on Japan much more easily than China. But it's quite possible a lot of this debt is financing the sort of corporate expansion that occurs in China as they've been industrializing. And on that front, I mean, their success in industrialization is breathtaking. Speaking as somebody who went there in 1981, 82, and then went back, and I think the first time I went back after that was 2016 or thereabouts. I mean, Jesus Christ,
yeah.
The difference in the country. And a huge increase in the industrial sophistication of the place. So whatever comes out of the financial side, China has used the whole globalization push to dramatically increase its industrial level. And what I expect to come out of what's happening now with COVID locking off, long-term supply chains and so on, they may well take the engineer's approach of reorienting their manufacturing to local consumption.
Yeah.
And
well, that has always been, that's been the aim anyway, hasn't it? To try and boost the domestic economy and be less reliant on the export economy. But the money that's funding that is coming from bank loans. This corporate debt is coming from bank loans, and the banks are by and large owned by the government. So does that make it really almost just an extension of modern monetary theory? And I want to get back to talking about how much of what the government is doing is actually MMT. But I mean, it's in effect, you know, it's just government money through an intermediary, isn't it? Which the government also owns.
Yeah, and like if you look at the data at the end of the global financial, or in the middle of the global financial crisis, is really the give there, because. And again, levels of credit growth in China are astronomical. It's the highest rate of growth of credit, I think, in global history, including Japan. The rate of change of Chinese private debt through the period from 2000 to 2010 is about three times as fast as it was in Japan during its bubble economy days. But when you hit the global financial crisis, hits in that stage. Private credit was roughly equivalent to 20% of GDP. It then plunged during the crisis from 20% to about 15%. And then this is when the government got in there and basically told the banks to lend to anybody with a pulse. And it went from, let's see what the time period was, it went from 15.5% of GDP at the end of 2008 end of 2009, 38%. So an enormous, and that was basically the government saying lend to anybody, and that basically gave you the boom which started the whole empty skyscraper syndrome for residential accommodation, but also a huge amount of other developments in China, including the growth of the high speed rail, et cetera, et cetera. So China uses both its government funding and its bank funding as a sort of form of extended MMT.
But they do have a share market as well. I mean, people are buying shares in these companies. Who wants to buy shares in the company if it is so highly leveraged? Because at some point it's going to come back to bite. Either, the situation as you described, where the company collapses and the government buys it, or it just has to pay off the debt and therefore it can't take on any more debt, which it's sort of like become dependent on, and growth has to slow. And then, that's when share prices start to fall. So why would people be buying into these companies?
Two reasons. One is because you don't get a decent return on your bank account in China. So everybody either invests in real estate or shares. There's an enormous amount of leverage speculation in shares as well. I don't know the level of margin debt in China, but I've got a feeling it's substantially higher than in America. And the Shanghai share market is like a Wild West share market compared to even to the New York Stock Exchange. So the volatility there is huge. But again, in some ways, the government is underwriting a lot of this stuff. Xi doesn't want an unhappy Chinese populace. So if you start seeing share prices collapse and then that leading to the private sector unrest, then I think you'd see policy to reinflate that particular bubble again.
But he is trying, isn't he? And I guess it's a long road, but he is trying to introduce more regulation, not just in the finance sector, but also in the way companies behave as well. So, for example, the way they, so it's more international standards, for example, on things like privacy. So he's, cracking down on the on cybersecurity and the technology industry over privacy, also, cracking down on monopolies and. I guess there's an aim, or it looks like there's an aim, to try and get China to operate more on international norms. Although, ironically, foreign investors are looking at all of that going, oh, my God, that's more regulation and control. Who knows how far this is going to go? We better steer away from it.
Yeah, but equally, he's putting pressure about the level of inequality in China. And this is one way reason that, I'm a bit of a cynic. That might be a surprise to you to hear that.
Good Lord.
Good Lord. But a cynic about what we call democracy in the West, because democracy basically means you get the best government the corporate sector can buy. And, the governments in America, Australia, Europe, England, they're travesties in terms of representing people's actual will. Now, of course, there's a one-party state in China, and I don't know whether they actually hold elections there. I think the elections inside the Communist Party occur, but I don't know the election any broader than that. But, you vote for one party, which one are you going to get? On a superficial level, that means less democracy, less responsiveness to what the people themselves want. But the reality of that is that If you don't get what you want in China, you protest. And there's a massive number of strikes and demonstrations that occur in various parts of China. And the Communist Party itself, which is on the scale of the Boy Scouts, this is what I learned when I was there back in 81, 82. I think at this time, in 81, 82, the population of China was roughly a billion people. And the Communist Party had 30 million members, meaning one in every 30 people was a member of the Communist Party, which is crazy levels membership. But what it meant was you didn't know whether the person you were talking to was or was not a member of the Communist Party, but you were going to hold your cards very close to your chest in case they found out that they were and you'd get reported for your views. But equally, what it meant was there were all these people monitoring. What are the people saying? What are they really thinking? And you partly a suppression of that, but partly an awareness of it occurred. And consequently, the Chinese government is, quite frankly, probably more responsive to what its people want than the governments of the West.
Yeah,
and it's counteracted to some extent by having an authoritarian like Xi in charge, but that still means that there's a way in which the political system taps into what the grassroots feelings are like.
Yeah, it is. I mean, you said the word authoritarian, and it is. But then, is it authoritarianism for good? So, for example, they stop foreign companies profiting from providing education to China. They, if you were providing education services, you couldn't do it for profit. They're looking at baby formula under attack, basically stopping women breastfeeding. Which is bad for kids, apparently. Yeah. I was on formula, and look how that turned out.
God, what an advertisement for
breastfeeding.
Obviously,
ever.
You need more breasts.
Exactly,
yeah,
I need them early on in my life. Absolutely. E-cigarettes. I think they're saying that they don't want people to be sold e-cigarettes if they weren't previously smoking. So it can only be there as a preventative measure. So all of that sort of stuff, which on the face of it, you'd say is rather good. But then foreign investors are looking at that and going, oh, this is sovereign risk stuff. But which raises the question, why would China care about having foreign investors? If they can create the money through their own banks to support the growth of their economy, why do they want foreign money coming in?
Yeah, and this is often they want foreign technology, not foreign money. I mean, I think one of my favourite stories involves a delegation of Chinese Communist Party officials to Australia back in the 80s, or late 80s, early 90s.
Yeah.
And one of the guys disappeared into the bathroom, and they got worried he's in there so long, there's something going wrong, and they found him in there taking apart the dual flush toilet to work out how it worked. quite seriously. And then a huge part of the move to get the industrialization to have globalized, basically American corporations shifting their production to China, taking advantage of low wages and then re-exporting the goods back through a loophole in the American trade law to benefit developing economies. A huge part was let's get their technology as fast as we can. And they've done it. I mean, the technological level of China is, eons. Its technology is pretty much on a par with America. And that is incredible transformation from 30 or 40 years ago. So largely they want the technology and they want the marketing links. They don't need or want the money.
Well, and they are leading the innovation in lots of areas now as well, aren't they? So it's not like they're stealing stuff from overseas. They like a lot of artificial intelligence, a lot of drones and stuff like that all came out of China. So that was stuff that, that they've originated themselves rather than stealing from elsewhere. But what happens if China, you mentioned it yourself, that they turn their focus more on their domestic economy more than an export-based economy. What's that going to do to the rest of the world that's become dependent on all of these exports from China?
And suddenly, the goods we take for granted, very cheap television sets and stuff like that,
become more expensive. Because they're selling them for domestic market more, and
you don't have the volume anymore. I mean, if there is a breakdown in global supply chains, then the important thing for the Chinese is going to be maintaining a supply to keep the populace happy in China. Mm. Their capacity to be nationalist about this far exceeds what happens in the West.
And it's going to help their GDP. So household consumption is about 70% of GDP in OECD countries. In China, it's about 35% because most of the GDP is coming from exports. But if you push household consumption up, it's going to help, whether GDP is a meaningful figure or not. So you can see why the emphasis. But I mean, conversely, that's going to be very damaging to GDP outside China.
Yeah, well, the American corporations were quite happy to screw American workers to take advantage of low wage in China and increase their profit rate at the expense of aggregate demand back in America. No qualms whatsoever. As I said, the Chinese have done this specifically because of the unrest in the country itself about the pathetic state of its people under Mao and the Gang of Four, and that desire to raise the living standards of China, the average Chinese person to the point where it's comparable with the West, that's been the driving force behind China's industrialization. And a large part of what Xi is talking about now is reducing the inequality. And they're putting some of their billionaires behind bars in a very scary and dangerous way. In a lot of cases, but at the same time, they're taking inequality more seriously than it's been taken in the West.
So the West is going to be paying more for stuff. This gets back to what we were talking about last week, where, are we going to find that consumption is going to be a more expensive behavior? And are we going to have to consume less? And is China going to be part and parcel of that?
Yeah, I think it is. We're talking also about how an authoritarian economy and government can potentially cope with climate change more easily by imposing rationing with much less protest than you'd get in so-called libertarian countries. And I think that's going to apply with China, that you'll be able, if you have to be told you've got to consume less, then China can do that very rapidly to its people in a way that the West cannot do. And you would get the climate equivalent of COVIDiots coming out complaining about it in the West. That will happen to a far lesser degree in China. And therefore, they've got, I think, more capacity to cope with the limitations climate change will put on them as well.
Well, they would find themselves behind bars with the billionaires, wouldn't they, if they were too vocal. Let's look at government debt then. So you talked about how that had increased so much, particularly during COVID. Going into it, though, it was pretty large, obviously, as well. Going into it, half of that debt, the figures I've got here, show that it's actually local government debt rather than central government debt. Now, so they can't print their own money. And there's not a lot of transparency in this local government debt. We talked about the shadow banking sector years ago when we were talking about China, because they use dubious financing vehicles to generate this debt, to fund this debt for these local governments. That could be a problem as well, couldn't it? I mean, that's been the an area of danger for some time in China, and I mean, that could just implode.
Potentially, yeah. I mean, because they don't have the cash revenue anymore. I mean, when I was in China with my then partner, one thing which fascinated me is how are they paying for these developments on the periphery of these major cities. And you would find most of these super skyscraper things would be built out slightly outside the main city confines. And it turned out that was the financing for the local government would come from selling it to property developers. So they'd sell land at a markup. It was basically vacant land. You'd sell it as a markup, and that would finance the local government and its own activities within the normal city boundary.
Not a sustainable model then.
No, not a sustainable model, no. So it could fall over. But again, creating the money is not China's problem. And because it's...
But it is for the local. It is for the local government, though.
For the locals, it is, yeah. But they can be bailed out as selectively as the top leadership wants to do it.
Mm. Yeah, yeah. So, okay. But I mean, that is a step away from, it sounds like they're trying to clean up their game a little bit by introducing more regulation in the finance sector so that then they are building a sustainable future. They can't keep on behaving that way. I mean, even though the money is coming from modern monetary theory is based on the assumption that money that is generated is used for some useful purpose. It's there to create jobs, not to build massive unoccupied skyscrapers as a way of funding local governments. So there's got to be a shift, hasn't there?
I think there has to be. But again, I just think China's got more capability to bring about that shift than a country hobbled by the accoutrements, but not the reality of democracy. With an ideology of liberty rather than an ideology of collective growth. And in many ways, you can see what Xi is doing now about the inequality there, emphasizing that collective side of Chinese ideology Where you try doing the same thing in the States, and of course the billionaires would outmaneuver you, and put up a public relations campaign to undermine the laws themselves, which wouldn't get passed by the Senate and the House of Reps. They aren't problems China faces.
But there's a sinister side behind all of this, though, isn't there? Because if China is more inward-looking now, it's going to be less reliant on international trade going forwards because it's got its own domestic market. So it becomes much more self-sufficient. They build up their military. For example, Taiwan is spending $1.4 billion, it was in the news this week, $1.4 billion on new fighter jets, but which the Americans are very happy to sell them, of course, because they're worried about increasing military activity by China. And, you know, there's the islands in the South China Sea. At some point China might say, yeah, we want to take Taiwan back. It's always been ours. That could lead to, you know, an escalation of conflict. In any case, there could be an arms race with China, which we've not had before, because it's growing into an economy which is self-sufficient, less dependent on international trade. And we know international trade is one thing that stops wars.
The other thing which fascinates me about the Taiwan side of things, though, is that Taiwan's the world's leading manufacturer of chips. And that's, you've got to credit the Taiwanese industrialists, because they have developed an advantage even over America without the need for the relocation of production trick. It's
all the more reason for China to say, well, that's ours. Why, we don't want to pay for these. We want to own them.
We don't want to import them. We want them to be produced domestically. And the way to that is to make Taiwan part of China. So and if we're seeing now a shortage of chips, which was partially driven by droughts in Taiwan that apparently have ceased now. I've got to check up and see whether that's so or not, but apparently the droughts that were affecting China's chip manufacturing, because the chip manufacturing is incredibly intensive on water. I mean, one little thing, learn a little snippets that you could never learn without the help of the things like YouTube these days. And part of the reason that chip manufacturing requires water is that water is used to focus the beams for the sub-micron level of manufacturing of computer chips. The technology is self-apparently coming from the Netherlands, so I believe. But with the drought, that means you don't actually have an essential input for producing the chips. So that's partly the chip shortage. Now, that may not happen anymore, but if China realizes that it's dependent upon Taiwan for an absolutely essential component, which it itself has not managed to produce domestic equivalents, then, yeah, that could be a reason we see them saying, well, we're going to annex Taiwan. So, exciting times ahead.
Yeah, so we can almost leave on a high note as usual, on this one. But also just the money. I'm not quite sure what the money supply is in China, but I imagine with all of this money that's been created to fund this debt, it would be increasing enormously, wouldn't it? And therefore, wouldn't we expect that if this was to continue, that we'd see a continued devaluation of the yuan? And what impact does that have? Maybe less if they're involved less in international trade. Maybe they're less concerned about the value of their currency.
Well, they're also running a trade surplus, so devaluation doesn't tend to hit countries running trade surpluses.
Yeah, for now. But they're always going to run a trade surplus, aren't they?
Well, with the manufacturing base they've got, I've got to actually take a look at we might flesh this out at a later stage by taking a look at the China in the MIT Atlas of Economic Complexity to see what they actually import. It's such a huge country, both population-wise and area. So many resources it has domestically. It can consider shifting from being relied upon exports to thinking, okay, well, relatively forget about exports and produce domestically. It's got more capacity to insulate itself than a country like the UK, for example, which has to import 30% of its food, more.
And is Australia buggered if China becomes much more self-dependent and doesn't need any Australian coal or iron ore?
Well, That again comes down to the quality of ore, and in some cases that's Australia's saving grace, that the stuff that's been eroded away and deposited courtesy of droughts and rains over eons, Australia tends to have higher quality iron ore and higher quality coal as well. So, but if China decides to cut back on coal, which I think it could do very rapidly if you start seeing climatic catastrophes occurring, then it's going to put the primary emphasis on domestic coal rather than imported from Australia, yeah.
Right, okay. Well, let's finish off where we started, because the question was really about, from Hilliard, was about, you'd identified China as one of those countries that was going to experience a crisis. But from what you're saying, because of their whole MMT approach, their ability to print money in their own domestic economy, in their own sovereign currency, there's not going to be a crisis.
Yeah, they can continue maintaining it, and they're actually more likely to write off debt. The version of what I'm talking about in terms of a debt jubilee is more likely in China than Western nations, where the finance sector dominates the politicians.
All right. Well, interesting to watch how that all unfolds over the coming years. Good to talk, Steve.
Okay. Next week again. Yep.
Yeah, not sure what we're going to talk about next week. If you've got any suggestions, please drop us a line. It's going to be interesting, though, isn't it, if China does sort of default on its debt, or just write it all off, or just continues to rack up more debt using modern monetary theory, whether we in the West start to say, well, okay, maybe this is the way, maybe the finance industry needs to have less influence, and we need to change the way we deal with debt. Don't hold your breath. You might turn blue. That's it for this week. I'm Phil Dobby with Steve Keen again next week. Thanks for listening.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
If you've enjoyed listening to Debunking Economics, even if you haven't, you might also enjoy The Y Curve. Each week, Roger Hearing and I talk to a guest about a topic that is very much in the news that week. It's lively, it's fun, it's informative. What more could you want? So search The Y Curve in your favorite podcast app, or go to ycurve.com to listen.